Hi, my name is Stefan Karpinski. I'm loosely affiliated with MIT. This is my colleague, Jeff Bezanson. The two of us and another colleague of ours, Viral Shah, who is in India and so couldn't make it to this conference, created Julia, which is a fast dynamic language for technical computing. Our patron is Alan Edelman. He's actually in the theoretical math department at MIT, but he funds our work to a large extent. So the term neat versus scruffy came up yesterday during the panel discussion. I think we're distinctly in the scruffy camp, but we're trying to bring the scruffy camp a little closer to the neat camp. So that's sort of the angle that this presentation is coming from. So the initial question you might ask is, why do we need a new language for technical computing? In particular, why a dynamic one? Why not use C with MPI or something like that, or use Haskell or some other strongly typed language? And the main reason is just because these languages that are dynamic are incredibly popular. It's sort of a de facto standard in linear algebra work, in numerical computing, to use MATLAB. That's even what is used in presentations in place of pseudocode. So in papers, you'll see MATLAB code. In statistics, R is the de facto standard for the same sort of way. NumPy, SciPy, becoming more and more popular as well because it's open source, and also because it has better performance in some cases than these other examples. I think a huge driving reason behind this is that a lot of the people in these areas are not professional programmers. They're not programming language buffs. And they like the ease and simplicity of these languages, the fact that you can just get things done. All of these approaches have a split language thing going on, where there's the high-level language, which is nice and easy to use, but then if you really, really want performance, you need to drop into C or C++. This manifests itself as a requirement for vectorization. If you want to get good performance out of MATLAB or R, you need to do vectorized code. You can't write the loops yourself. Although MATLAB has a JIT these days, so sometimes you can get some good performance, but it's limited. You can't always get it. There's also no productivity boost if you're writing libraries. If you're writing libraries and you want good performance, you have to write it in C, so you're not getting the benefits of a high-level language. So that limits the productivity that the ecosystem as a whole can have. So the key features of Julia, what make it different and interesting and a special snowflake, are, first of all, a sophisticated dynamic type system. So it's not a static type system. It's really more of a tag system than a type system. So you can keep tracks of the types of values, but a lot of the times we can eliminate the tag overhead. But it's got dependent parametric types, so you can express collection types precisely. And it supports all sorts of polymorphism, ad hoc, parametric, generic programming, duck typing. All of these things are possible. Multiple dispatch is core to the language. It's the unifying paradigm. And what we found is interesting, because there's been a lot of languages that have supported some form of multiple dispatch. But if you really, really embrace it as this is the, it's not a choice between single dispatch, but you can also have multiple dispatch if you want it, but maybe there's some downside. If you really embrace it and make it really, really good, really fast, really reliable, it kind of changes the way you think about things, and it allows you to start to do a lot of things that you wouldn't think you could do with multiple dispatch. It's also a broad spectrum language. This came up yesterday with regards to Haskell, that you can focus at the right level of abstraction. And so we don't want to have to switch languages. We don't want to have to be in C and then switch languages to get to the high-level stuff. We want to be able to write the same thing, A times B, and get that to be a single machine instruction or have it be something that starts up an entire cluster. So that requires polymorphism. Question? Everything is based entirely on the runtime types of values. There is no compile time semantics. So that keeps things nice and simple for people to understand. So the challenge, I'm going to take questions after the talk because otherwise we'll run out of time. So this is just an example of some low-level code. You'll note that there are no types mentioned anywhere here, but this runs at C speed or close to it. It's within it's about one point something times C. You could, for example, you know, pass in a much more complicated structure. But if A is just an array, low and high are just integers, then this will just, you know, do what you want it to do. One of the ways that we get performance is aggressive specialization, and Jeff will talk about that a lot later in the second half of the talk. Right, next slide. This is some medium level code. This is more like MATLAB. This is what you would write where, you know, instead of, you know, dealing with individual addresses in an array and individual indices and looping over them, you just, you know, call higher level functions that generate a bunch of random data in a matrix for you, and then you can do things like concatenate them in block fashion, calculate a trace, calculate a, you know, transpose product, and just do some statistics. As you can see, this is it looks very similar to MATLAB, so it should be familiar to people who come from a scientific computing background. Here's an example of some higher level code. This is distributed array programming. And you also see some types here. So what you can see is this is a copy to operation where you're copying from one distributed array to another. And they can have different distributions. They can be distributed across different machines in completely different ways. And this code right here takes care of everything that needs to happen in terms of sending the right information to the right places. Just to dive into it a little bit, the sync, that's a macro. We have, there's a strong Lisp tradition to Julia, but we do make it explicit when you're calling a macro. So it doesn't look like a function call. It has a different syntax. So you know that something interesting is going on. That synchronizes spawn at P just basically says, you know, spawn at processor P, this local copy to operation, which takes the local part of the destination distributed array, and then the second localized call actually just figures out the correct indices on the source destination array that match up with the destination array, and then it just does the local copy piece. And it does all of this at every single processor, and then just returns the distributed array object. So we have in-language support for remote references and global distributed objects that makes it nice and easy to do distributed programming. Well, it's in the library. It's not actually built in the language, but there's strong support for it. And just as a comparison, this is an abstract implementation of the copy to that will work for any sort of abstract array type. And it's, you know, very simple. It's not parallel. This will run on one CPU. The multiple dispatch comes in here because when you have a D array, this copy to method is called, which then dispatches to this copy to method potentially, although we actually have other specialized ones that are faster and use memcopy if the layout of the array is correct. Next. So calling C in Fortran, this is really, really important for scientific computing because you have to call the good libraries. It would be insane to re-implement LAPACK yourself. So it's much better if you have C compatibility in your memory layout and you can just call it. This, for example, is how you call get PID. That's it. That's all the code. There's nothing else to do. To show that, I mean, other things are relatively easy too. Integers are super simple, but for example, strings work. You know, here you have a command that's just a string. You can call system with it like that. All you have to do is basically encode with the explicit type system how system is expected to work. If you want to do something a little more complicated, you can just dynamically open a library. For example, this is libfdm, which is a good libm implementation, and call the Vassell J0 function, and then just define a method. And that's it. That's all it really takes. And this can be done in the REPL dynamically, so you can play around with it until you get it right, and then just throw it in a library. This is a more complicated example where we're using memset to fill an array with a particular byte value. And it shows a little more of the sophisticated type system. So I'm going to dive into a little bit what's going on here. In the curly braces after fill is basically T is a type parameter, but you can quantify it over all a union of int8 or uint8. So this basically says T is either an int8 or a uint8, and A is an array with that type, x can be any kind of integer, it'll automatically convert x to the expected type of integer, which is an int32. The array will be automatically turned into a pointer that C can understand, and then it just calls memset for you. End of story, you're done. This is so easy and seductive that we have people just sort of starting to wrap libraries for us because it's fun. So we get, you know, zlib, someone started with MySQL yesterday or something like that, and it just, you know, like, oh, okay, cool, awesome. Now we have bindings for that. Carry on. So I'm going to dive a little deeper into one specific example where multiple dispatch gives us a lot of power. There's this problem of numeric promotions, right? And different languages deal with it different ways. There's some that are really, really strict about it, like Ada is, you know, super uptight and you have to explicitly cast everything or your operation is going to fail. I think OCaml may be the same way, but I'm not an OCaml programmer, so probably someone in this room knows about this more than I do. Obviously assembly, you know, values are just values. Most languages, though, find this too annoying. You know, you can't, if you can't write 1.5 plus 2 and have it, you know, give you 3.5, it's just, you know, you go crazy. So it's built into the compiler. There's rules built into the compiler usually about how to do this. Operators like plus, times, all these numeric operators, they're really the, you know, they're the prototype for multiple dispatch. They are the one of the most dynamic things in most traditionally compiled languages. So by adding multiple dispatch, we actually allow operators to just become functions because all of our functions can do this. So we've come up with something that's more generic, more extensible. You can do it with any sort of new, you know, user-defined numeric type. You can just have the same kind of promotion semantics that all the built-in types have. In fact, our built-in types are just user-defined types. Yeah. So the way it works is this. It's pretty straightforward. You have this promote function, which is defined in Julia, and it basically takes two types, two objects of two types, and it figures out by looking up a promotion type table, which is also defined as a method, just what type it should be converting to, and then it just converts the two methods, and that's it. And it returns them. And then what you do is you can just use this everywhere. So if you have the plus operation, you just have a method that says, well, you know, if I have two numbers and I don't have a more specific rule for how to combine them, what I should do is try to promote them to a common type and then try to add them. So that's the built-in stuff. When you are actually adding a new numeric type, all you need to do is define this promote rule, which is used by the promote type method to figure out, you know, do a little bit of manipulation, basically make it symmetric, make sure all the things work out the way you want them to. So you define, for example, here, if I have a float 64 and I have a complex 128, which is, you know, two float 64s, real and imaginary parts, the way I should promote them is I should promote them to a complex 128. That's the target type for this particular combination. And then you just have to define how to do the conversion. In this case, it's just a matter of constructing a complex 128 with the real part being the floating part value and then a zero for the other part. And then all you need to do is define plus operation on two complex values. And now any combination of float and complex will work correctly. And we basically have maybe, I think, you know, not very many. I think it's probably like, you know, 6 or 7 different promotion rules in the complex definition, and now it just interoperates with absolutely every single other type in the system. So this avoids, you know, this becoming an n by m problem where you have to define all these different rules. You have n plus m instead of n by m. I think Jeff's going to take over and talk to you a little more detail about how we get this performance. Yep.
All right, can you hear me? Okay, hi everyone, I'm Jeff. It's great to be here. So I'm gonna go into a little bit more detail about you know, exactly what our types are and how the compiler works and things like that. So our type system itself is not really so extremely fascinating. Is the really interesting thing about it is just that we have it, really. Because, you know, several times in the past people have applied The kind of type inference that we use, which I call dynamic type inference, I think some other people have called it that too. They've applied type inference to existing languages like Common Lisp and Python, and any sufficiently popular dynamic language has kind of gotten this treatment. But what we did is sort of design it, design the whole thing with that in mind from the beginning, which let us do a few things that were valuable, which is one thing is in building the libraries we could sort of consciously trade off which things we were willing to give up performance on and which things that we wanted to make sure could be well typed. So as we were writing the library, it's a good discipline to have. And second of all, it lets us sort of be a lot more profligate about abstraction. And we're just willing to make everything, very abstract, like the numeric promotion example. I mean, that code does lots of, semantically dynamic dispatching. It uses argument splicing, to take a function that returns two values and use those as the two arguments to another function. It does all of this stuff. And yet that's used for, individual scalar, like scalar plus and scalar times. So, that's a lot of, machinery to deploy for just like scalar plus. So we can only do that, with confidence that we'd be able to speed it up, or else it would be really slow. So what does our type system look like? There's kind of a more usual part and a slightly less usual part. This is the not too unusual part. There's a declarative type hierarchy. You can have abstract types and declare that certain concrete types are subtypes of them. And we have composite types that are a lot like structs, and we also have these bits types, which basically lets you declare that something's representation is just a bit string. So you can define like int 8 and int 16 that way. We have tuple types, which are really useful to represent argument lists and multiple return values, of course. And we have a notion of union types, which is really a set union of types. It's not like a C union type, or it's not like a an ML style tagged union kind of thing. It's just sort of a set union. So you can actually ad hoc construct a union of any two types. Like one of the examples showed a union of int and uint 8, of int 8 and uint 8. So you can just put any two types together in a union, and it means the type that includes both. And types have parameters as well, and all of our parameters are actually invariant. But we have a sort of a syntax that lets you do dispatch in a way that gets around the restrictiveness of invariance that I'll show. But something like this, so there's sort of a type application there, but the weird thing about us is it's completely dynamic semantics. It's not, none of that is statics. So semantically, the way this executes is you have some type constructor, basically, and you apply it to some type. So that's actually, everything is evaluated. And then it's evaluated, you get the type, and then you apply that to arguments to construct something. So it's all runtime semantics. And of course, we optimize that when we can figure out what's going on. And all of these constructors have forms that will infer the parameter for you, so you don't have to specify it. Okay, next. Okay, and then there's this sort of parametric methods feature, which is sort of more of a feature of the dispatch system than the type system per se, where you can have a static parameter on a method that has some constraints, and that parameter is sort of matched against candidate argument types. So you can say, I have a type variable t that has to be some kind of integer, and I can have an array of t in the argument list, and that will then match any array whose parameter is some kind of integer type. So that lets you get a sort of a effective covariance in terms of dispatch without the actual types themselves being covariant. All right, and then there's this feature of it's really most similar to singleton kinds in type theory, where you can have a type whose only element is some particular type, and we found that extremely useful actually, because it lets you basically write the equivalent of class methods, essentially, where you can have methods that are defined on a particular type rather than on instances of it. So here's a simple example of doing something like a type trait, where you can say that the size of an int 16 is 2, and then you can actually just call that on a type. So having all these things just in the language as values, is sort of very, we think it's sort of a very convenient way to program. You don't have to think about
you know, what's evaluated at compile time, what's a static, you know, parameter, what's a dynamic variable. You don't have to think about it. You can just have a variable whose value is a type and just pass it to a function. And, you know, and if the compiler can figure out what's going on, it'll be fast. If it can't, then it won't be as fast, but, you know, at least you had a good time. here's an example of a slightly interesting type. So this is something that's useful for us to be able to express in our domain. This is basically the type of matrices you can pass to LayPack, which is either, it's a union, and it's basically either a dense matrix or a certain contiguous subarray of a dense matrix, because you can pass stride values to LayPack functions. So we have a subarray type, basically, that just wraps an array with a range of indexes and accesses it indirectly. So we can say this, and there's a constraint here that the subarray has to be of some kind of dense array. And so also what this shows is, so array is a parametric type, but what's happening here is you can just say array without any parameters, and we kind of automatically give you an abstract supertype of all concrete arrays if you don't write any parameters. So that's very convenient for stuff like this. All right, so now I'll go into a type inference a little bit. So as we've said, you know, some of you might be twitching that I'm just talking about dynamic typing. These aren't real types. And yes, that's true. It's not types. If that bothers you, just replace the word types with tags. This is sort of a tag system, not a type system. If you prefer thinking of it that way. And the game in dynamic type inference is rather than the compiler needing to prove what the type of everything is, it simply attempts to guess what the type of everything will be. And then it just gets as much information as it can. And actually, one thing that's really nice to me about that kind of type inference is you can just be constantly improving and refining the type inference algorithm without changing the language spec. The programs just get faster. So how does it work? It's basically sort of a data flow based algorithm. It's a maximum fixed point data flow type inference, where you just follow the intermediate representation and handle all the forms. Everything is lowered to a simple IR that just has assignments and function calls and that, you know, very little else. And then, you know, for every call you apply a type transfer function for the function calls, and they're just the language has a very small number of built-in primitives. A really, really tiny number. So all you need to do is manually code in the type behaviors of those primitives, you know, which are things like type of and type assert, you know, which have really simple type behaviors. And then the algorithm gets you the types of everything else. And this is actually one of the advantages of doing the language this way is not only is it more convenient to write all the libraries in a higher level language, but it's better for the compiler too, because the compiler can analyze everything. You know, if you have some higher level language with all the heavy lifting, all the libraries written in C, it's really pretty difficult to analyze that C code to figure out what its type behavior is with respect to the domain you care about, right? So having all the libraries available in the language gives the compiler all that information. So it's actually much better for everybody. And the big magic is this last line here. This is sort of the key one equation I would write for this if I had to write an equation. And so what this says, so this is basically the type behavior of one of our multi-methods, put very concisely. So basically what you do is to infer the type of some generic function on some argument type, which is a tuple type. We're just going to take the big join over a bunch of things. And each one inside is we're going to intersect or meet. We're going to meet the argument type that we've inferred for the arguments with the declared signature of the method, and then recursively run type inference on that, and do that for all of the matching signatures, and then union all those together, essentially. And so that's sort of the engine that drives gathering all the type information from all the multi-methods and inferred argument types. There are a few optimizations you can do in the process, of course. Like you can you don't have to go through every signature for every method. You know, of course, because once you've looked at enough that you know that the signatures you've looked at so far must contain the inferred types, you can stop, and things like that. And so these especially these meet and join operators, you know, once you have a slightly complicated type system like ours, are actually really pretty difficult to implement. they're pretty significant, you know, especially in terms of figuring out what the parameters are and everything. We have to do a small amount of constraint solving to, you know, to figure out what the parameters have to be to find a type that's contained in two other types. But we do that. And the nice thing about it is, again, since because of the nature of dynamic type inferences, all of these things can be sort of conservatively over-approximated. That, you know, if some method matches, but it's too hard to compute, you know, the smallest possible type, I can just say, you know, you can just widen everything, you know, whenever you want. You can always just go to any. If you're, you know, you can throw up your hands. If a type gets too big, if you have a union with, you know, too many things in it, you can just say, okay, any, and, you know, and keep going. And you'll still be correct, but you won't get as sharp types. But at least you'll still be right. So that's, you know, that's another nice thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, from there, you know, once we have all this type information, there are a few really simple optimizations that turn out to be extremely helpful for us. So of course, okay, number one is where we get most of our type information to sort of feed this process is by essentially through a method cache that you know, intercepts the first time a method is called on some new signature. And in general, we specialize methods for basically every combination of argument types you call it with. And that's the point where we can, you know, where we can interrupt and run the inference the rest of the way and get all our type information. We don't, you know, it probably occurs to you that, well, if you do it for every combination of argument types, you can get a combinatorial explosion, and yes, that's true. So we actually have, we do a little bit of trickery to try to contain that a little bit. We use some tricks like you can generalize type a little bit. You know, for example, you know, if you have a var args method, you probably don't want to specialize it for every single, you know, length of arguments you could pass to it. You don't want to specialize it for 10 arguments, 11 arguments, 12 arguments. Right, so you can take a signature and try to sort of generalize it so that what you put in the method cache is you know, a little bit more general and can be reused more in, you know, for future signatures. So we do a little bit of that to cut down on the amount of specialization. We do lots of, you know, call site specializations, inlining, direct function calls of skipping, you know, dynamic dispatch, and there are even more things like that we can do. So people love the argument splicing thing where you can, you know, our syntax for it is dot dot dot, or, you know, in Python it's star. You know, people love doing that, splicing things out as argument lists. So we, you know, that comes up a lot. So we need to optimize it. So, you know, we can do these simple rewrites of uses of this apply thing where, you know, if you're applying a function to a, you know, immediately constructed tuple, you can lower that, and so on. And same thing for multiple return values. You know, if you have in your hands the things that are constructing the return values, you don't need to construct the tuple, you know, et cetera. So these, you know, those for us are really, really helpful optimizations, even though they're very simple. All right, and here's the resulting performance. So these benchmarks are not super amazing. They're really generally really simple micro benchmarks, like just doing, you know, simple summing things in a loop and just, you know, very, very simple micro benchmarks. Because it's just making a very, you know, minor point about performance. The scale is actually a log scale. So, you know, some of these things like, you know, Octave, R, MATLAB are really, you know, in some cases 1,000 times slower than C on some of these things. You know, most of these, actually the first four are, you know, are not idiomatic kinds of MATLAB or Octave code because it's doing scalar operations and most people do vector operations, of course, but, you know, everyone can call BLASTs and LAPACK. So, you know, if you were just doing matrix multiply, you'd only be benchmarking BLASTs and not the language. So it's really just about the language. A question? Oh, yes. I should have explained that. So the graph is actually times relative to C. The bottom baseline there is the time of them written in C, and everything else is time relative to that. So lower is better. But this one all the way over here on the right, this is sort of my favorite benchmark because it's a little bit more complicated. This is actually the code that Stefan showed earlier. Should we show it again? Can we go back?
Yeah, sure. So this code.
Yeah, so this is the code for the benchmark all the way over on the right. And so this is doing, it's making some normal random matrices, and it's concatenating them, and transposing them, and multiplying them. It's doing a bunch of array operations. But the arrays are small, and I think they were 5x5 arrays. So that's kind of an interesting case, because you are doing array operations, but you don't have that much of a chance to make up, the overhead. So you don't get to spend a huge amount of time in your kernels, because the arrays are so small. So in that, how that works out, all right, back to the benchmark. So how that works out is we're still about 3 or 4 times slower than C, but from that very, very high level code. So we feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, the C code is about, I don't know, 150 lines of crazy calls to LAPACK and lots of mallocing and freeing. So
yeah. We're significantly faster than these other environments, because we're able to comprehensively eliminate that overhead by specializing all the call sites and everything.
Should be noted on here that V8 is impressively fast on everything. The main problem is it has not such great interoperability with things like LAPACK.
V8 JavaScript is very impressive. They beat us on a couple of these, actually. Yeah. These numbers are not the newest things. There's an arms race, these numbers are a little bit unfair to some of these systems and a little bit unfair to us, and because they're a little bit old, but it's only a couple months old, so it's pretty much the same story.
We have up-to-date numbers on the website for the
numbers on the website. We update regularly. All right. So not everything is roses. A few disadvantages with our approach. Anytime you have multiple dispatch, you can have ambiguities because some methods aren't, some signatures aren't well ordered. In that case, we just print a warning. And it's nice that we can compute the intersection of all our types, because we can actually print a really useful warning that tells you which definition is missing. So, that can be a little bit annoying, but, at least we can tell you exactly what's wrong. I think our memory usage is a little bit high. Actually, no one has complained about it. It doesn't seem to be a problem in practice yet, but I think it's a bit high due to, we regenerate code for things a lot. We keep around all our compiler data structures, that sort of thing. So we use a little bit more memory than you might like. You can't realistically run it in less than 200 megabytes, which is, not a lot by today's standards, but it is, maybe more than you'd want to spend on, just having your language runtime potentially. But we try to do a good job. One thing we do is all the type information and compiler data structures like ASTs are actually stored serialized, because an 8-bit and a 64-bit pointer is way too big. So we actually keep everything in sort of a serialized byte format in memory, and we expand it when we need it and then put it back. We have to, with our library, which our library is now something like, 25,000 lines of Julia code, I think, which is, it's pretty good density for, pretty broad coverage of the functions you need in a basic MATLAB-like system. But for those 25,000 lines of code, it takes you need to do a bit of a bootstrapping process to, give the compiler some time to digest, all the type information it can get out of it. And it takes about 15 seconds, which is, It's too long to do every time you start the thing, but it's not too bad to do offline. My modularity is a little bit tricky in a system like this, because it's kind of a method definition free-for-all. Everyone can put any signature into any method anywhere at any time, which makes it, really, really convenient, and you can just define anything really quickly, but it's not clear how to draw the lines of modularity in that kind of a case. So it's kind of a whole program compilation kind of thing right now.
We are less dynamic than, say, Ruby. You can't monkey patch types. Once a type is defined, that's the way it is. So that helps.
Yeah. And then another kind of deficiency of this this kind of type system is the type information sort of only flows in one direction, because everything has to follow the semantics of eagerly evaluating the arguments and then pushing them into the function. So that's sort of The types just sort of follow the forward data flow. So you can't have a context that requires a certain type and therefore do like return type overloading. So we can't really do that. So that's something that's missing from this.
Okay.
But you know, despite it not being perfect, people seem to like it. We're a pretty young project. People have only known that we existed for about 6 weeks. we did a blog post about 6 weeks ago, sort of announcing this thing, and it seems to have really struck a chord with a lot of people, because we've got people are kind of flowing in at a steady pace, and these are some of the things we've seen people saying. You know, I especially like that second quote: "Where has Julia been this past 2 years? I had searched for it high and low, day and night, to the point of nearly driving myself insane." It's just how we felt. Why can't I just get good performance from this, this code the way I like writing it? So some people are interested in this. So the quick stats of where we are now, and all of this is in the past 6 weeks. 6 weeks ago, it was like just three people and, zero anything else. And since then, we have 100,000 visitors, about 3,000 people have downloaded the binaries or source, over 1,000 followers on GitHub, and now we're up to about 40 contributors. But that includes everybody. There's some drive-by bug fixes and that kind of thing. But there are 40 people who've touched the code base now, and in fact, at least four of them are named Stefan. So yeah, there's julialang.org. Check it out, yep. And everything is on GitHub.
Yeah, thank you. We keep having new people who are starting to implement new crazy things like Monte Carlo simulations, Gibbs sampling, image processing, R-like stats functionality.
Next slide.
Do we have a next slide?
Do we?
No, we don't.
Oh, we don't. Okay.
Yeah. I do want to make sure to thank. We have a Windows port as of a couple of days ago, and it's this guy named Kino Fisher, who is a very, very good hacker, and just came along and ported what we thought would take maybe a long not happen for years, but came and ported the whole thing to Win32. You can download a binary and try it and run it on Win32. Also supported on Linux and OS X. But
and we found out he's actually still in high school.
Yeah.
So, find this guy, watch him. Keep your eye on him.
He's going to be a star.
you want to take a few questions?
Any questions now?
Can you say how Julia handles parallelism? What sort of constructs you have?
So we've moved all the parallelism to our libraries. We have just a couple things in the language we think support it, like macros, closures, and then it's really all defined in the libraries. We have our parallelism model is just a multiprocessing, so we start up multiple processes and we just have them communicate.
It's sort of MPI-like, but significantly easier to use. You can also serialize almost everything. You can send a closure over a pipe and it just works. That makes a lot of programming styles very trivial to write.
We've implemented some things like distributed arrays on top of that.
I'm probably showing my age, but have you ever looked at Dylan? Seems to have a lot of features like
those.
Yes, I
think like actually Dylan is probably the closest, the closest predecessor to what we've done, really. Yeah.
So I noticed that you have union types, mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how, what advantage that gives you. How do you use them?
So the main reason is that because of the lack of typing rules, a function can do something like return either an int or a string, and so we can use it to keep track of that.
It's right, used by the compiler internally, but why not expose it to the rest of the world?
On one arm of the branch, you can return an int, and on the other one, you return a string, and so we can infer that to be union of int and string, and then.
But once you have that, how do you use that information
later? So then if that union type were then something of that union type were passed as an argument to something, we would that union type would be what we are intersecting with the signatures of the method. So we might be able to use that to narrow it down to just one method, for example.
So I was curious if you
had any data or looked around at when you're choosing to do multi-methods. And I'm asking because many, many years ago when we were working on Dylan, which is interesting you bring it up, we were looking at whether to do that or not, and we surveyed a bunch of libraries and found you only used multi-dispatch in about 10-12% of the cases, but we weren't looking at operators. So I wondered if, did you survey and do a bunch of looking at that, or you just found it was so important for operators you chose to do it?
Yeah, we didn't do a survey. I think it was just our instinctive feel of, you know, thinking about mathematical operators that, you know, made us think we wanted that. I think that was pretty much the reason.
Also, Jerry Sussman's scheme, numeric scheme library, is based on multiple dispatch, so, and that's a good pointer that you might be in the right direction.
All right. Let's take the rest of the questions offline. Thank you very much.
Yep, thank you. Yeah.